On the program today, and this is completely serious, 20 candidates on a debate stage this week. Economically speaking, that is no laughing matter. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York City today, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, the 25th of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Let us tick through a list, shall we, of things we keep track of here at Marketplace that constitute the real economy, the thing we all live and work in. Job creation is one, certainly. Wages is another. There's real estate, too, the most expensive investment most of us are ever going to make. And to that end, news from the Commerce Department today that new home sales fell almost 8% last month. April was down as well. The reason we bring it up is that mortgage rates, how much it'll cost to borrow the money to buy those houses, are down as well, more than a full percentage point over a year ago. So Marketplace's Justin Ho gets us going with what's going on there.
30-year mortgage rates are 3.8% on average, just a hair above two-year lows. Rates like these can make buying a home seem a lot cheaper. Mark Fleming is chief economist with First American.
So in the last few months, we've seen big gains in purchasing power or house buying power for consumers.
But monthly fluctuations in mortgage rates probably aren't going to make or break a decision to buy a house, says Blair Duquesnay, an investment advisor at Ritholtz Wealth Management.
So if we just look at a $200,000 mortgage, a 1 percentage point drop in a 30-year rate equates to about $100, maybe $125 a month in savings.
Plus, those ultra-low rates aren't for everybody. Duquesnay says a lot of factors can affect a home buyer's mortgage rate. Their credit score, yes, but also the type of home they're buying, their income, their savings.
Interest rates are different in different parts of the country. They're different if you're buying a single family home versus a condo.
And before you can even think about a mortgage, you need to pull together a down payment. With inventories near historic lows and home prices rising, down payments are getting more expensive. Mark Fleming at First American says first-time home buyers almost never put 20% down.
The single largest impediment for the first-time home buyer to becoming a homeowner isn't the cost of financing, it's accumulating that down payment.
And if a borrower doesn't accumulate enough of a down payment, that can increase their mortgage rate too. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Quick math test before we go on. How much meat is in 40 million McDonald's quarter pounders? 10 million pounds is the answer. And it's germane to this next story because McDonald's says it sold 40 million more quarter pounders in the first quarter of this year than it did in the first quarter of last. And as Marketplace's Renata Sago reports, it's all about where the company is getting all that extra beef.
The fast food giant credits a switch from frozen beef patties in its quarter pounders to fresh ones as the reason for its rising burger share. RJ Hottovy, senior restaurant analyst for Morningstar Research, says it was a high-risk move that took years to pull off.
Not only did the suppliers have to prepare or have more supply of fresh beef, but you know the franchisees had to make changes within their stores.
Like adding new refrigerators to maintain safe temperatures, increasing the required cooking temperatures after the switch to fresh beef, and changing packaging.
So it was not a cheap endeavor.
Franchisees had to fork over a lot of cash, says Bert Flickinger, who runs the retail consulting firm Strategic Resource Group. His family's business used to supply meat and produce to McDonald's. He says all these changes are good for suppliers in the end.
This way they can ship all the refrigerated fresh product on the same trucks. They ship the fresh tomatoes, the fresh lettuce, the fresh vegetables with the fresh meat.
McDonald's has embraced fresh beef to compete with its rivals like Wendy's and Burger King. Other fast food chains are moving in a different direction. More of them, like White Castle and Carl's Jr., are selling imitation meat burgers. So far, McDonald's is not doing that. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
This next story is a commingling of patent law, profit expectations, and how much Americans pay for their medications. AbbVie, which makes the popular drug Humira, is going to pay $63 billion to buy Allergan. Botox is its big blockbuster. Marketplace's Eric Barris has more on that one.
AbbVie's big moneymaker is Humira. You've probably seen its ads.
I never knew when my symptoms would keep us apart.
Humira treats arthritis, Crohn's disease, and other disorders. Allergan, on the other hand, is best known for Botox, a mostly optional drug used to treat wrinkles.
Own your look with fewer lines.
Both companies have been under pressure lately to improve their performance. Humira's U.S. patent is set to expire in a few years. Jared Hulse, a healthcare strategist at Jefferies, says that means AbbVie has a few options to grow.
You can either internally develop drugs, which is costly and obviously time-consuming and doesn't always work. Second, you could do a string of smaller acquisitions.
Or you could go all in, fork over billions and buy a big company like Allergan. It's had problems of its own. It started strong thanks to Botox, says Sean Nicholson, professor at Cornell. But now,
they're not bringing enough new products to the market.
Investors today saw this as good news for Allergan, not so great for AbbVie. But it's an expensive gamble for both companies that may not do much for consumers, according to Amit Sarpartwari, an epidemiologist and lawyer at Harvard.
Ultimately, the prices that they're paying through these acquisitions are then going to be reflected in the prices that patients pay for the drugs.
This merger will still face antitrust scrutiny. Other big pharma mergers have been held up by regulatory concerns. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Interesting thing happened on Wall Street today. You remember a week ago after the last Fed meeting, everybody said, oh, yeah, for sure, Jay Powell is going to cut interest rates a half a percentage point at their July meeting. Well, today traders started to get it into their heads that maybe that is not going to happen, and they were sad. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The first set of Democratic primary debates is this week, tomorrow and Thursday nights. The 20 of them who cleared the bar, the Democratic National Committee set to try to bring some kind of order to the process. Order notwithstanding, though, 20 people and the whole idea of knowing who's who and what they stand for is challenging, especially when it comes to, economic policy. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains what having so many voices on stage does to our heads.
The Democratic Candidates Debate.
Ready for the flashy graphics, patriotic music, and lots of zingy one-liners? You might want to also prepare a cheat sheet to keep track of everyone. Or maybe a spreadsheet.
Taking the Miami stage will be Cory Booker, Julian Castro, Bill de Blasio, John Delaney, Tulsi
Yeah,
Gabbard,
lots of candidates. And let's just imagine for a moment that Democratic voters cast their votes based solely on where those candidates stand on actual policy, as opposed to, say, likability or popularity. With 10 people on stage each night for two nights in a row?
It's actually a cognitively extremely difficult task.
Jonathan Levav is a marketing professor who specializes in decision-making at Stanford. Polls show healthcare, immigration, and, of course, the economy are top priorities for primary voters. And those issues are complicated. Levav says sorting through umpteen policy proposals, to say nothing of the tweets and ads and Instagram posts from 25 different candidates, can lead to decision overload.
Everything in economic policy is very, very nuanced. And so then simple messages in that regard are going to be more appealing.
For example, he says, rewind to 2016, when candidates crowded the stage in the Republican primary debates. And which voice stood out?
If I'm president, there won't be stupid deals anymore.
Trump's effectiveness in the last election comes down, at least in part, to the fact that he was speaking directly to the American public in simple terms, and people got it.
John Maynard's a psychology professor at Florida State University. He says when it comes to decision making, there are decision optimizers who try to get all the details, then make the best choice they can, and decision satisfiers who can tolerate good enough and keep it moving.
And what happens during an election season like this is choice overload can turn decision optimizers into decision satisfiers. People start making more quick and dirty decisions.
Maynard says just because it's a quick decision doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad decision. And it's worth noting here, a lot of decision-making research has focused on how consumers choose among 20 kinds of jam or 30 types of whitening toothpaste.
Democratic primary voters are not picking a candidate the way they might pick, you know, a box of cereal. And primary voters are very sophisticated.
Margie Omero is a longtime Democratic pollster at the firm GBAO. This cycle, she's working with the campaign of Montana Governor Steve Bullock, who didn't qualify for the first debate. Omero acknowledges we've never seen a field this big, but
in a debate of really any size is not necessarily the place where people can see a long, detailed policy proposal.
Candidates have websites for that, and town halls, and lots of other events. Omero says debates are more about voters getting to know a candidate.
They want to see somebody who they feel they can connect with, but they are also looking for somebody who, you know, can understand the issues and has a, you know, policy depth.
But not so deep that voters feel like they're drowning. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Fashion covers a whole lot of bases in this economy, everything from super high-end to T-shirts, really. And when I'm talking T-shirts, don't think cheap. Think Kanye West and his sneakers and his hoodies, a pretty mainstream staple of the fashion world right now that's called streetwear. Used to be, though, that streetwear was smaller, sort of an extension of a lot of different subcultures, skateboarding, punk rock, and surfing as well. That's the world into which Bobby Kim, better known to his customers as Bobby Hundreds, launched a T-shirt business that eventually became the L.A. streetwear company, The Hundreds. He's got a new book out, Bobby Kim does, about that company and what he is trying to do with it. It's called This Is Not a T-Shirt. Bobby Kim, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Maybe we ought to start with a definition for those who aren't completely up to speed on what streetwear actually is. I mean, you're a practitioner, a seller, a purveyor of. What does it mean to you?
Well, streetwear on the surface level is fashion subgenre, I guess you could say. It's T-shirts, it's limited edition sneakers. It's those crazy lineups you see outside of stores with kids carrying skateboards. But on a deeper level, I think streetwear represents a community, a culture. It's even beyond a lifestyle. It's really a meeting grounds for youth culture to congregate.
Why? What makes you say that? Where'd that come from?
I think what it is that it's a very creative platform. It's a medium where anyone can get involved. In fact, it becomes everyone's first business or brand foray because the barrier of entry is so low. To build a brand, to create a T-shirt, is just to design a graphic. You can put together an Instagram profile. You have a Shopify cart, and all of a sudden, you're up and running.
And then that basically, I mean, you didn't do the whole Shopify cart thing because it wasn't around. But
that's right.
15 years ago, right? That's basically what you did. You designed a couple of things and you got them printed out.
Yeah, that's exactly how it happened. In 2003, we started a brand. My friend and I, Ben, we just designed a few T-shirts, put them up in an online shop. And before we knew it, it started taking off. I think it was largely propelled by the fact that I had this ongoing narrative around my blog. Pre-social media, this was how we kept in touch with our audience and were also transparent about our culture and our lifestyle.
First of all, blog. I mean, you're dating yourself, right?
Yeah. In the early 2000s, we had these things called blogs, short form for web blogging. It was a way for me to just kind of journal about what I was eating every day and also just us skating and hanging out on the street, and also designing and drawing cool T-shirts.
So let's talk about the brand for a minute and brand identity. One of the things you do in this book, you've got a sort of an FAQ at the end about, you know, here's how you go about starting your own business or building your own brand. And you are emphatic that your brand vision, one's brand vision is what it is. Don't crowdsource it. Customer is not always right. In essence, stick to your guns.
Yeah. I think people flock to brands because they represent an identity. They represent a person with an opinion. And we come to that brand for exactly that. We're not coming to them to give them what we think. If we want to do that, we can create our own brands, which is happening more and more. And that is something that I encourage and I think is really exciting. But I think you're out there for a reason and we need you. We need your voice. We need your opinions and we need you to stand out and to stand for something different.
There are great sort of founder's story anecdotes in this book about the first time you went to get your t-shirts printed and that whole thing. And it was really interesting. I want to pick one example, though, where in essence, it becomes kind of a fight, actually, with you and your co-founder, right? Of whether you wind up selling these t-shirts in malls, right? And here are a streetwear brand trying to make it, and you're going to a mall?
Right, right. It was more or less frowned upon in our space to sell mainstream, mass scale, whether that was to a shopping mall or to just a chain store in general. And it did happen. You know, we ended up selling to a much bigger base. And for a while there, I had trouble navigating those relationships with our customers. I felt like I had lost a lot of that human connection, that touch point with our base. But eventually, we figured our way back. And that came through by way of social media, through the internet, and me just being physically more out there. I do my best to do interviews like this, podcasts, and actually just be on the road touring universities, touring shops, stopping in and just being as available to our customer base as possible, especially if that means opening up my DMs on my Instagram or my Twitter and spending hours a day just responding and helping young kids who end up becoming the next big fashion designers. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Bobby Hundreds, also known as Bobby Kim, he's got a book out. It's called This Is Not a T-Shirt, by one of the co-founders of the streetwear brand The Hundred. Bobby, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Kai.
We talked a bit longer than just that, as you might imagine. You want to know how Bobby came up with the name The Hundreds? Well, we've got a video of the whole interview. It's on our YouTube channel. Marketplace APM is where we are. Subscribe while you're there, please. Coming up.
If you're reading this, Doc Brown was unable to get lightning to strike the clock tower at the right moment.
Which is why I'm out of the office. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 179 today, 0.6%, 26,548. The NASDAQ down 120 points, 1.5%. Finished at 78.84. The S&P 500 dipped 27 points, 0.9%, 29.17 there. AbbVie and Allergan, we told you about. Allergan jumped 25%. AbbVie, though, sank 16%. Shares of home builder Lennar slid 6.2% the day after it warned of higher materials costs because of U.S. tariffs on Chinese imports. Lennar said those tariffs cost about $500 per home it builds. Other home builders slid as well after those new home sales numbers we told you about. D.R. Horton down 3.8% today. Pulte Group lost 2.3%. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note. Once again, thank you, Jay Powell, down to 1.99%. You're listening to Marketplace. And as we approach the end of Marketplace's budget year, we're doing some numbers of our own. Part of being a responsible news organization, especially one that covers business and the economy, is fiscal responsibility. And we've got a target we need to hit by June 30th. We are closing in on our goal of 2,500 Marketplace investors for this drive, but we still do need to hear from you. Even a gift of just $5 will make a difference. So please donate today at marketplace.org. And thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is Pride Month. You've seen the rainbows, probably. It's also the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Uprising, a pivotal moment in the gay rights movement in this country. There are pride celebrations in a lot of places commemorating Stonewall. There's also a lot of very visible corporate support. Company logos are now rainbow-colored. Rainbow flags are hanging on offices and government buildings, even on the New York Federal Reserve down on Wall Street here in Manhattan. LGBTQ people and support groups have worked for decades to get that kind of acceptance. Some, though, have started asking whether there is such a thing as too much. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that story.
June 28, 1969. 20-year-old Dale Mitchell and his boyfriend are walking down the street through the West Village in New York.
And we saw up ahead a bunch of flickering blue police lights.
The police were raiding the Stonewall Inn, as they often did, harassing and arresting the clientele for being gay or gender nonconforming.
The police were carting off the patrons to a nearby paddy wagon and three drag queens, if I remember correctly. The cops particularly like to pick on drag queens. One of them broke free, and she said, "Come on, you faggots, let's riot."
They did. And after that uprising, something changed in the gay rights movement. It became louder. Pride marches across the U.S. were set up to commemorate Stonewall. Eric Marcus is a historian and hosts the Making Gay History podcast. He remembers one of his first Pride celebrations in 1980, and he says back then, these were protest marches without a lot of mainstream support.
Because gay people were sick, sinful, disgusting, horrible, illegal people. Nobody wants to be associated with gay people, and no corporation, no company selling things other than perhaps a bathhouse would advertise to gay people. No, it was laughable.
That changed. This is from CBS coverage of San Francisco's Pride Parade in 2018.
One of the larger contingents on this parade route as well, Amazon.
Google always has a huge contingent.
Yeah, Levi's, Wells Fargo, Macy's.
I think it's great. I think it's terrible.
Historian Eric Marcus again.
I live in Chelsea in Manhattan. Last year, I saw a float go by with a rainbow painted outdoor patio chair, and it was for a patio furniture company. I thought, this has just gone too far.
Last year's New York Pride Parade had more than 100 floats and 550 contingents, including corporate sponsors and small businesses. The business presence and LGBTQ-oriented advertising generally feels exploitative to people like Robin Scott. She tried to march in one of New York's Pride Parades last year with a nonprofit group.
And we were supposed to step off at 2, and at 6, we still hadn't left. And I'd spent 4 hours just circling behind an inflatable Chipotle burrito. It was just advertising, and the whole parade was choked with it.
Which is why this year she's marching in an alternative Pride Parade in New York, the Queer Liberation March. It's the same day as the main parade, but in the morning. Ann Northrup is one of the organizers.
And mostly there will just be people. No corporate floats, nothing like that. And we've even had a few politicians who want to march with us. And we've had to tell them, look, this is just not the place for campaigning.
Northrop's concerned that some corporations are just using LGBTQ images to make themselves look better, something she calls pinkwashing. At the same time, she acknowledges corporations have been critical to promoting LGBTQ causes, non-discrimination and domestic partner benefits before gay marriage was legal, for example. More recently, many businesses opposed the bathroom ban in North Carolina that targeted trans people.
So Wells Fargo has been committed to the LGBTQ community for just over 30 years now. It goes back to 1987 when we first incorporated sexual orientation in our non-discrimination policy.
John Lake is a VP of marketing for Wells Fargo and says his company's donated $50 million to LGBTQ charities and advocacy groups over the last 30 years.
Our participation in Pride actually goes back 25 years. We've been involved with Pride events since 1993.
He says corporate visibility may be old news in some large cities, but not everywhere.
Where their visibility, I feel, really matters is in smaller communities around the country. You know, we're in places like Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and Winston-Salem, and Anchorage, Alaska. And, I feel like our visibility there means so much.
Ultimately, corporate visibility during Pride, whether it's marketing or floats or rainbow flags and logos, is a product of the movement's success. The idea that there might be too much corporate visibility was nearly unthinkable 50 years ago. Back then, beer bottles were smashed against police vans. Today, beer bottles have rainbow flags on them. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The first official week of summer has arrived, and with it, an increasing number of those out-of-office automatic email responses. I'm out of the office till such and such a date. Might not respond to your email right away. You know the kind, right? Pretty straightforward, most of them, but there are some that land in your inbox and you say, that was pretty good. I wish I'd thought of that. So today we start an occasional series, Automatic Reply, highlighting the more creative ways that people say, yeah, you know what? Try me again later.
If you're reading this, Doc Brown was unable to get lightning to strike the clock tower at the right moment, and I'm stuck in 1955. I won't be able to respond to emails until July 10th, 2019, or until email is invented, whichever comes first.
That was Shiva Stella. She's the communications director at a consumer advocacy group called Public Knowledge. Do us a favor. Tell us about an out-of-office email response you have seen. We'll get it on the program. Marketplace.org is where you can do that. This final note on the way out today, just because we give a nod to the Federal Reserve up at the top of the program and what people are guessing about what the Fed may or may not do on interest rates when next it meets. Chair Jay Powell was in New York for a speech today, and he said, in essence, we'll see what the data says about a rate cut. But then, and we're playing this because every time the president says he has the authority to fire or demote the Fed chair because he doesn't like its policies, it gets all kinds of play, even though he actually doesn't have that authority. Well, we're playing it because then, in his speech today, Powell said this.
The Fed is insulated from short-term political pressures, what is often referred to as our independence. Congress chose to insulate the Fed this way because it had seen the damage that often arises when policy bends to short-term political interests.
July 31 is the next Fed meeting, gang. Mark your calendars. Hey, Marketplace listeners, it's Kai. We've got a new podcast out I think you're going to want to subscribe to. It's called This Is Uncomfortable. It's a weekly show about life and how money messes with it. It's hosted by Rima Kreis. She tells funny and honest stories about how money affects relationships and shapes identities and often defines what it means to be an adult. Please subscribe to our new show. It's called This Is Uncomfortable, and you can do that wherever you get your podcasts. All right, we're going. The Dow Industrial's down 179 today, 0.6%. The NASDAQ off 120 points, 1.5%. S&P 500 down 27 points. That is 0.9%. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Steve Bion, Danielle Chiraguayo, Joanne Griffith, Annika Houston, Ben Hethcoat, and Sarah Menendez. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.